All right.
Well, let me ask you just first to talk about your genealogy, that is, you know, where you were born and your family, and just a little bit about yourself in that regard.
Well, I was born out at Halstead, Kansas. You wouldn't know where that is, but that's on the main line of the Santa Fe Railroad between Kansas City, well, between Chicago, Kansas City, Denver, and the West. At one time, the main artery of traffic. Of course, the Union Pacific would always argue that with you, but then the trains used to whiz by there on double tracks, and it was really a artery of traffic that opened up that entire area. I can remember very well the land agents coming by to see my daddy, to see if he wouldn't consider selling his little farm there at Halstead and taking up a homestead in western Kansas, because they wanted to open up the western part of the state, because the traffic from western Kansas was very, very light, and they still had a lot of land there. The Santa Fe was granted a lot of land in order to build their railroad through there. And so they often came to see him, but he was planted very well there in a neighborhood where they all were of the same religion and all were of the same origin and all belonged to the same church. And we naturally hoped that he wouldn't fall for this. And then, of course, when the big boom opened in the Rio Grande Valley, they came to see him and try to get him to move down to the Rio Grande Valley. A lot of people, of course, fell for that. Many of them went down there, went broke, and moved back home and had to start all over again. This is a small community. It's my happy privilege to speak there at the closing session of a medical convention a week ago. And the town's about the same size that it was then. It's very interesting, but the town is not as big now as it was at that time. It had two hotels, and now it's got a few motels in town. And, of course, it's beginning to grow because they're getting some industry in there now. They have found that by moving into these communities that have no industry, it used to be a big milling center. And then, of course, the big milling companies bought up these small mills and closed them and threw all those people out of employment. My daddy at one time was a miller before he became a farmer. And he bought his small farm and then, of course, lived there until he passed away. And we, of course, were brought up in the western part of the state. And I want to tell you one thing. The plains of Kansas were a lonely, lonely place to live in those days. They had no telephone communication until later. There were no such things as automobiles, and you wouldn't see anybody until you go to church on Sunday. And that, of course, was my background.
What were your father and mother, what were their names?
Well, my father's name was Henry Rupp, and he was born in Galicia, which is a Royal Crown colony of Austria. It no longer exists. My sister went over there several years ago to try to find where he was born, but it was absolutely impossible because it has been kicked around like all those small countries have there. At one time, there were about 10 or 12 little small nations in there that have all been now absorbed into these other bigger nations. And my mother was born in Greenstadt, Germany, which is near the French border. And they both came to this country and both came to this same community to live. And that's where they met, and that's where they got married. And unfortunately, they just about spoke the same kind of language, because the people that daddy came from that moved into Galicia were Germans that were promised, as they did in those days and still are now, a lot of rewards if they come in and help settle an area. And they went in there, but a bunch of them got dissatisfied and moved out and came to Kansas. Mother's father was on the wrong side when the German Empire was formed in 73. And as a result of that, they made life very miserable for him. He had a very nice a plantation. And before him, his father had a castle. They're trying to restore this castle now, or trying to get all of us that trace back to that original family to contribute to restore this. It isn't a huge castle, but it's still a fairly nice affair as far as we are concerned with here in this country. But my father, my mother's father, built a place at outside of Greenstadt in a little town. It is surrounded by a high wall, and everything they had, of course, was in there. I often sat there and listened to Mother talk about how, when she was a child, they would cross the bridge and go to the forest, and she described the fields and everything. And it was my happy privilege when I was back there with the army to go there and find the family home. And I was in the family home, and I was invited in there for dinner. It's no longer, of course, in the family. There is a same man by the same name as Mother's name, but it was, we are not sure that he was related to the family. And, of course, they suffered tremendously during the war. And one of the daughters who lost her husband took me over all the fields. I walked with her through the beet fields and through everything else, spotlessly clean, and went with her through the pasture and crossed this bridge that Mother often talked about that continued to flow on, over a little small stream right at the back of the barn, and everyone had to pass over that. But at night they brought all the livestock in and kept them in the stables. And when they locked the door, which was still a custom to this day, they were isolated for the night.
Mr. Rupp, I don't think you mentioned your mother's first name or maiden name.
Well, my mother's name was Anna Lichti, L-I-C-H-T-I.
What about your education? Where were you educated?
Well, I was educated, unfortunately, I could speak very little English until...
We'll just cut it off. I'd ask you about your education, and you...
Oh, I could speak very little English until I went to school, because we were all Germans. Everybody in that neighborhood for miles and miles and miles and miles around were Germans. We went to English school for 7 months, and then the German school for 2 months, and or maybe 6 and 3, I don't remember what the proportion was. But after my oldest brother, my oldest three brothers went to school, they used to bring some words home and talk, and I picked up a little English, but I still had difficulty when I got to school, because I had very little knowledge of English, because we spoke German at home. Well, we did even after I was in college. When we'd come home, Mother never acquired a working knowledge of English, although she read all the papers and learned English in that way. But she still preferred to speak in German, and all of us, of course, respected that. And we talked German at home. And it is only after, after the later years that we'd all speak English, and of course she acquired a good working knowledge of English because the church changed to English and everything else, so she had to learn English, and we all, of course, started, of course, from the same background.
Mr. Rupp, you achieved all of your secondary education in Kansas.
Yes, I went to District 33, a school about a mile and a half from our home, and I worked there. I went to school there, and I worked there as a janitor of that school. Now, that was an important position the last 2 years when I was in the 7th and 8th grade. It paid $1 a month, but the teacher only made 40, so the dollar was better than any of the other kids were making, and that gave me a lot of liberties that I liked. I always got there in the morning and built the fires. I'd wash the blackboards and clean out the erasers, see that chalk was in the trays and everything else. And I always saw to it that the coal would run out about 10:30, which would allow me to get up and go to the coal shed, which was outside. And it took me an awful long time to fill those coal buckets and bring them in. And we had a big pot-bellied stove like they had in all the depots at that time. And I'd fill this with coal. And then during the noon hour, I was always careful to see that we'd run out about 2:30 or 3, because school lasted till 4. Then at 4 o'clock, I banked the fire and banked it real good with big chunks of coal so that I'd be sure to have a fire going there in the morning when I arrived. If not, it is up to me to build a fire. And they provided me with a bunch of corn cobs that they always brought in there in a big truckload. Not a truck, because they didn't have trucks in those days, but in a big wagon load. And then we had kerosene, and I'd saturate them and then throw them in there. Then we had little wood splinters, and I'd put those in there and get the fire going and pour them in the coal. And that is my job. But that is an important job, because I had the liberty to get up and go, and I was a big shot around the schoolhouse. Then I went to high school and drove a horse and buggy 7 or 7.5 miles every day, back and forth, sometimes getting home at 11 o'clock at night, and it can get awful dark on those Kansas roads, and I just have to leave it the horse because I couldn't see myself. And the horse always found its way home. And then I'd get up early in the morning. My job, of course, was to milk the cows. Before I'd leave, I'd have to do that, then get ready and drive to town and be to school at 9 o'clock. And I played basketball. If there's nothing else to do, I came home after basketball practice and usually got home in time to help do some farm work. When there wasn't any basketball practice, I was able to do that. And there was no such thing as idleness. We were all assigned jobs. When Daddy passed away, my oldest brother, I believe, was 16 years old, and he had to take full charge of the farm. Then my other brother was about 13, and I was, I believe, 10 or 9, I don't remember, I think about 9 years old or 8. But we were all assigned jobs. And my job was, of course, to take care of the pigs. And I had to lug the corn there and get the water to them and everything else. And then usually milk 2 cows. We milked about 7 cows, and my assignment was 2 cows. And that was a job that I had, until my last 2 years, when I got a job in town and stayed in town and worked my way through school in a grocery store and then in a restaurant. Then I decided there must be an easier way to make a living than farming, and that's all you had to look forward to. There was nothing else to do. a boy out there even now just hasn't a future except to work in one of these, in my area, at Halstead, in a mobile home factory. That's the only factories they have there. And they make a lot of those mobile homes in that area. And the only future I had was to go to college. And I decided to do that. I got off at Emporia, Kansas, and all of them there decided to go to Emporia State Teachers College or the College of Emporia. And we waited around till about 4 or 5 o'clock, and I had a friend that lived about a mile and a half from where I lived by the name of Roy Lehman. And he said, "I'm going on to University of Kansas." He says, "I'm going to take the shot at the big league, and I'm going to go to the state university." He says, "Why don't you go with me?" He said, "There's nothing here." He said, "Why fool around down here?" He says, "Sure, you can make the team here, but why don't you go up there and really try to play some ball on a good team?" I deliberated that, and the train left about 5:30, and I had to decide what I was going to do. So I said, "I'm going with you." Well, we got up there to Lawrence, Kansas, and they had a streetcar. We didn't know a thing about where we were going to school or anything else. So we said, "Take us up on the campus." Well, they took us up and dumped us on Mount Oread. And we looked around. There are a lot of buildings up there, but that wasn't what we were looking for. We were looking for a place to stay. So the next streetcar came along in about 20 minutes, and we got on it. And I told this man that was running the streetcar, I says, "Now let us off in the main section where the students are." And there were all the students, just thousands of them, just hollering at each other and, "Hello, Jake, hello, Bill, hello, Marie," kissing each other and everything else, just having a big time. And here stood Roy and I with our suitcases on the corner, wondering where to go. So we stopped one of the boys and said, "Where could you find a room?" Well, he said, "Just go up and down the street, and they'll have a sign up there, rooms for rent, and go in there." Well, we walked down about a half a block, and sure enough, there was a room, a sign up, room for rent. We went in and looked at the room, and it's a nice room. We decided to take it. So she wanted her rent in advance, so we paid it. And after we got unpacked and everything else, I said to one of the boys and the other one that we met there from Coffeyville, Kansas, I said, "Where's the toilet?" He said, "Well, it's out in the back. It's an outdoor toilet." I said, "You mean they don't have a bathroom?" He says, "No, they don't have a bathroom." I says, "Good Lord." Well, that's the reason that room was vacant in that section of town, because you'd had to go out maybe 8 or 9 blocks to find a room for rent that had a bathroom in the house. Well, we got stuck there, but we made it all right, and we'd go up to the university. We soon got acquainted with other members of the boys that wanted to play basketball, and we'd take our showers up there. And then the job was to find a job, and I says, "Well, a man that like we are, that's always had an opportunity, because we never had any trouble finding a job. We'd thought we'd go and just say, we're looking for a job." So we went to YMCA, and they said, "Well, we don't have any jobs now, but we'll let you know as soon as we do." Well, every day we checked back with them, no jobs. I said, "That's funny." But all the kids at that time were working their way through school. This was right after the war. And they were working their way through school, and they had gotten these jobs ahead of schedule. They got them before they left for home, or got there 3 or 4 days ahead of us, and they had all the jobs. Took him about 4 weeks to find a job, and it took me about 8 weeks to find a job. And I tell you, those were the most miserable 8 weeks I ever spent in my life. And that's then, after that, we went to different rooming houses, and we had a very enjoyable 4 years together there at the university.
Looking back, since you had become the nation's foremost basketball coach, looking back at yourself when you were a player at Kansas, how would you evaluate yourself as a player then?
Well, I wasn't a great basketball player. Of course, we were national champions in 1922 and in 1923, as you well know. The 1923 team was undefeated, and I have many pictures of the team on the wall in my office, and we're going back for the 50th anniversary of our class on May the 18th and 19th, and we just plan to have a good old-fashioned time. Many of the wives are going to be there, and we're going to have a huge get-together that night with a nice dinner, and we're going to all stay at the same motel, and I'm sure that we're going to enjoy this more than you'll ever know, because when you take a bunch of teammates together that have been having these reunions now. We started, I think, at 35, 40, 45, this will be 50. And then the highlight, of course, will be when we all get together and go up and see Dr. Forrest C. Allen, who coached us. Of course, we'll be in a wheelchair, and we'll go up and see him. And, of course, he talks about the team. I saw him last year, and his memory seems to go back better to the teams of that era than they do to his more recent teams of Will Chamberlain and those folks. He just doesn't seem to remember those boys very well anymore. But he remembers everything that we ever did. And when we played out there, we went to see Fogg, and had a nice visit with him. He didn't want us to leave. And when I called for an appointment the day before, the next morning he got up and said, "When's Adolf coming?" He asked that question from his nurse 6 times, and she kept telling him he'll be here at 2 o'clock. And he just kept asking the question. So he was very anxious to see me. He's very proud of me because of the fact that I had been a successful in my life. In fact, everybody on that team had been eminently successful, one of them being the president of Phillips Petroleum Company and then chairman of the board, and all the others were also very successful in every line of endeavor that they were entered into.
Where was your first coaching job?
Well, I tell you, my first coaching job was a small town in Kansas, but when I found out that they didn't have a gymnasium and didn't have a foot, were going to have a football team and never had one or any equipment or anything like that. That didn't last long, I'll tell you right now. That ended that thing in a hurry. So my real first coaching job was at Marshalltown, Iowa, where I found out that instead of coaching the basketball team, I was assistant in football, assistant in basketball, and the head wrestling coach. I didn't know anything about wrestling, but I had a man on the team, a boy that is 19 years old, too old to wrestle in high school competition in the state of Iowa, and I asked him if he wouldn't help me. He had won the AAU championship at Corvallis, Oregon, at the university that spring in his division, and had never been lost a match in his entire life. He's a very fine wrestler. And he said he'd be more than glad to. Well, I didn't know a thing. I'd never seen a wrestling match in my life. Didn't know one hold from another. He got him ready, and of course, on the night of a match, he and I sat together, and he told me what to tell him, because I had to act a little important, because you couldn't have a student going out there, because that wasn't permitted. And then we went to the state meet. They wouldn't let him go, left me all by myself, but then I had the knowledge of the boys pretty well. We won that with a heavyweight champion winning the championship for us by 1 point. When we added his total to the other, we had to win it with a heavyweight championship. And I never felt as guilty in my life as when I walked up there and they asked me to come up there before a capacity crowd, because wrestling's a big thing out that way in Iowa and Kansas and Oklahoma and those states. Wrestling's a big thing. And they wanted to present the wrestling trophy to the championship coach, Adolph Rupp. And I never felt as guilty in my life because I hadn't taught those kids a thing. And then I had to present the trophy at an open assembly to the principal of the high school. I got a standing ovation, I think, because everyone there knew that I didn't know anything about it. And we had just a ripping good time. But I decided I didn't want any more of that. I wanted to get out on my own. Well, the principal and the superintendent of the school, they were violently opposed to me leaving. They wanted me to stick around there. But I said, no, I want to get me a job as a basketball coach. And I got to Freeport, Illinois. And, of course, I made a marvelous record there. And it was that record that enabled me as a high school coach to get the job here at the university, something that I don't believe will ever happen again, that a high school coach would get a job as a basketball coach at a major state university.
Let me about done pretty good here, about ready to get up to the line wrapping up. I want to get that turned around a little bit. Well, we got all the way to UK. I don't want to go through all these teams. It would take too long, and everybody else has done this, I think. But let me ask you about when you came to Kentucky, did you have a philosophy that you wanted to follow?
Well, yes. I copied a lot of things that Dr. Allen talked to me about. But when I was at Freeport, Illinois, I was just 70 miles from Madison, Wisconsin, where they had the most successful coach outside of Fogg in the United States, and that was Dr. Walter E. Meanwell. He had a standardized program that was of a pattern nature. Dr. Allen did not have pattern basketball, and I went up there. And I studied his style of play. I used to go up to see a lot of his games. And he let me sit up one time in his box. He had a box that was built in the old gymnasium where he and the players sat. And he let me sit up there with him. And I learned an awful lot of basketball from that man. And that, with the fact that the Shrine had an awful good team at Belvedere, Illinois, that took on all these traveling professional teams. I learned to put together a style of play that I brought down here and changed the fast break that we had at Kansas to suit myself. And I was very much pleased the other night when I saw the Russians and the boys from the United States play basketball to see that the Russians used a system of fast break that is based somewhat on my system, although they brought the ball out down on the side of the floor, while the boys from the United States brought it down the middle of the floor, and of course that was my style of advancing with a fast break. I think you always bring the ball down the middle of the floor where you have a pass off to the side. But the Russians, of course, have been very successful with their style of play. And I studied it at great length while they were playing the boys from the United States. Then, of course, I put in these plays up until five. Then six came as an accident, which was, of course, the most successful play that we've ever had here at the university. Seven was developed because Vanderbilt, under Bob Polk, caught on to how this six worked and wouldn't let our first man break through and gummed up our second guard around man. So we double-crossed and screened in the opposite direction, which still enabled us to make a pattern that allowed him to come around and shoot the same as he did under the six pattern.
Vanderbilt, and you covered that pretty well, looking after six.
All right. Now then, our seven pattern was something that I just picked up one time on my own because I, well, the seven pattern followed the six because that was a pattern that forced us by Vanderbilt stopping our six pattern, where we screened in the opposite direction. Then a eight pattern was a pattern that I made that would allow us to get a shot off either guard or our best forward. And our nine pattern was a pattern that was brought in as an improvement over the double screen that is used by Temple University. They have made such a great success of that play that I studied all summer in 58 after we had won the NCAA championship in Louisville, and only Johnny Cox was coming back. I said, we've got to work something out in order to get Johnny some baskets. I says, we can't just play our same old style of play. By George, we came up with this nine play, then ten play is a beautiful play that I just finally came up with on my own that we were so successful with and still are so successful with, and I see they're still running it here at the university. And we played the entire second half of that against this great Duke team that we met at College Park, Maryland, when we were rated number one and they were rated number two. And we were able to defeat them with a sick team from that we had picked up out at Iowa City. But I think our number 10 play is possibly as successful as any play. So the university system is built on the five plays I brought down here and the other five that were put in due to necessity.
Well, as a result of your phenomenal success in Kentucky basketball coaching, Kentucky has become, if not one of the top basketball states in the country. We like to think of it as number one, of course. And let me ask you, what through the early years do you think caused Kentucky players to develop so well? The Mountain Boys, their great leaping ability, and some great shooters like Johnny Cox. You think it's the style that you developed here in Kentucky, the run and shoot, that caused these boys to develop?
Well, I think I want to go back a little bit and not take the credit for all this at all, because Kentucky was playing some good basketball before I came here. As you'll recall, the year before I came here, Ashland won the national championship in Chicago at the Stag Tournament. And they quit that now, and I hated to see that fall by the wayside, because it took all the state champions from all the states and brought them to Chicago, where they played then for what was really a national championship team. And I thought it was a wonderful thing. And Carr Creek and Ashland represented us in that tournament. But Carr Creek had a good team, I followed that team very closely, because he'd went as a unit to Eastern, and while over there, I used to go over there and try to study the style of play. Turkey Hughes was coaching the team at the time, and I often discussed with him their style of defense. He says, I can't describe it. I don't know myself. He says, I just took them and handed them a ball and told them to play the way they did when they were in high school. He says, I put in a few things for them, but he said they're playing just like they did in high school. Ashland had some great boys that most of them made good when they got to college. But they've developed some great boys in the mountains, and now that it seems to have flowed more and more to Louisville and this area in here. Lexington had some great ball clubs this year. Louisville always has great clubs and always will have and always should have, because of the competing teams there are usually from large schools, and they've got a good program going in the Louisville system. Owensboro always is good, because they've been very careful in the selection of their coaches down there, and it's always been good. But I just for the life can't understand why they don't have better teams in the western part of the state. Of course, one year Cuba came up. That's just a little place in the road. I don't know if they still have a high school there or not. I doubt it very much. And they came up and won the state tournament. But Paducah and Mayfield and Fulton and those towns just don't seem to be able to come up with a competing team for the state championship. Northern Kentucky at one time was strong, but recently has not been so strong, and I don't remember many champions being from that area. At one time, the little schools dominated it. I remember Carr Creek winning it. I remember little town of Corinth winning it. I remember a team that King played on in Western Kentucky. What was that called down there? Bend in the Road. I don't remember what it was, right south of Paducah, a little town there. And I know I drove through it the first time and drove 5 miles through it before they told me, well, you got to go back there because there's only one store in town. I can't think of the name of the school now. And it is just a small little place. Jim King was, of course, the big noise on that team, and he came here to school. So the little towns used to dominate the team, the state champions, but they don't do it anymore.
You know, the mark of a great Kentucky basketball team was always, and still is, it seems the ability of the players to really whip the ball around, really pass it around fast, quickly, and then get off a good shot. Do you coach that?
Yes, sir, indeed I do. We have a drill called speed passing, where we get two competing teams, and we try to have 15 men out for basketball if we can, but of course, the last few years I could never get that many out. Lucky to have 10. And we try to see, by whipping these balls and interchanging the forwards and the guards, passing it back and forth and back and forth on one side of the floor. And then when the center passes it over to the other guard and he passes it to the forward on his side, the forward and the guard on this other side exchange places. And we try to see how many times in 1 minute we can move that ball without fumble. If you fumble, that ends a drill. And the secret of that is to see that you're going to meet the pass, to see that you follow through on the pass, and to see that the pass is always in the area where the hands swing naturally. Yes, we spend an awful lot of time on speed passing and moving. I've tried to teach the boys to not pass a ball to man when he's open. Oh, of course, you catch a guy, he's open, fire the ball to him, because that shows just a complete lack of defense on the part of the other team. But the secret of basketball is to give the ball to a man as he is getting open, not after he's open. Don't wait till he's open. Wait and give it to him while he's getting open. And I watched the other night this Russian team, and they were masters of that art. They fire that ball just as a man was getting open. The defensive man may have been trailing by less than a foot, but they fired that ball in to the lead, gave it to this man, and he'd get his shot away. But that foot was the difference in getting the ball away and not getting it away. And I think too many schools, they wait until the boy is open. They're too conservative because they don't know how to give the ball to a moving person, and they don't know how to meet the pass. And those are the two secrets of passing.
Out of all the phases of coaching, is there any one thing that is most important to playing good college basketball?
Yes, I think so. I think the main thing that's important in college basketball is the fundamental game position, and that is you're always on your toes. Oh, that doesn't mean you're standing on your toes. That means the weight is distributed on your toes. Your knees are bent, your hips are down, your back is straight, and your head is up. That means you're down. You're not standing up. This idea, when you see a bunch of boys playing basketball and the ball is on one side of the floor, the boy on the other side of the floor must keep his defensive man busy also, because if he doesn't, then that defensive man can slip in and help on the weak side to strengthen the defense on the strong side. But if you've got to learn to play without the ball, And if you are always in a position to play, don't stand there with your hands on your hips. That's no position offensively or defensively. But you watch a team play and see how many of those boys stand around there when the ball's on the other side of the floor, and here they stand with their hands on their hips.
Coach, which is more important, winning or how you play the game?
Well, the most important thing, of course, is how you play the game. If you play the game properly, you're going to win. I've always taken the attitude that the philosophy, it doesn't make any difference whether you win or whether you lose. It's how you play the game. It's a rotten philosophy of life and a rotten philosophy of sports. If that's the case, why do you have these playoffs that the professional teams are going through at this particular time? Why do you have the World Series? Why do you have the Super Bowls? Why do you have all these playoffs? And why do you have these golf tournaments? If it doesn't make any difference, it makes a lot of difference to Jack Nicklaus and Palmer and all these folks, whether they win or whether they lose. The whole thing is to do things properly. And there's so many coaches that think when they put in that hour and a half, hour and three quarters, or 2 hours, they put in a day's work. I've always said to the boys, have we put in an honest day's work? By an honest day's work, I meant, did we do something that was useful today, or did we just go through the motions? And I think that's right. If you do things properly and do things the way they should be done, you're bound to win. And that's my philosophy of the game. But then this idea, as I've always said, it doesn't make any difference whether you win or lose. Oh, no, you don't try to sell that to me.
Coach, I'm about done with you. I don't want to worry you.
All right.
I really...